time that I actually lived in Colville Road, I sort of seemed to spend quite a lot of time away from Colville Road as well, going up north to do various projects, for a couple of weeks to 5 weeks at a time. And I remember in 92, I was going off to Dartington Art School to do these 5 week visual performance projects down there. And also, I did an interesting project in Aberystwyth for about 5 weeks, working with these special needs people at a centre there, and got them to interview each other and work with their family photographs and photocopy. And they produced a large kind of tent-like installation in Aberystwyth Arts Centre. So I kind of worked at various different places, really, which as time went on, that wasn't actually conducive to the living situation there because of the squatting that was taking place, and you didn't feel that, it was okay to kind of leave the area for long periods of time and your work could be safe, really. So I decided in 1992 to use the place as a studio, but because there was damp, quite extensive damp in my studio by now because of the tiles that had been removed from 32 next door, the roof tiles, I literally closed off that lovely front room, well, what was once a lovely front room. And I'd use the room, the back room, which was previously my bedroom, and also my kitchen, because I had quite a big table in there. And I kept my washing machine in there as well, because I didn't particularly want to move that because I'd gone to Hackney into short life housing and was moving around a bit over there, like sometimes only had a place for about 6 months and had to move on, or a year or 2 years. And I eventually ended up living in Old Ford Road. But I suppose when I first moved into Colville Road, I remember one Sunday going up to explore Leighton High Road because it was the first chance I had. And as I walked up past the supermarkets and a little bit off track, there were these shops which were so interesting. They had where the owner had clearly done the window display, and I can't particularly remember what was actually in the window display, but what I noticed was this kind of brightly coloured pink or light blue crepe paper, which was cut over the board, the display board, and round the back of the screen, and sort of draped over and maybe cut into sort of a scallop shape or something, which I did go back to the house and comment on to Tara, who also really liked that because she liked the sort of slightly tacky quality of the handmade. But I suppose also that idea of an interest in the whole thing about mend and make do. And I think, the artists, we were like that in the sense that, like how we furnished our houses, going to secondhand shops and junk shops, picking up things and picking up wooden chairs and tables, and if they weren't in terribly good nick, we'd just give them a lick of paint. And how actually that attitude has stayed with me. I mean, like where I live now, I have got a certain amount of new things which I never did have before, but I still like the look of painted furniture. And my mum and dad gave me some 1940s wooden chairs which again weren't in terribly good nick. And I painted them a sort of pistachio green, and they look really good next to my grandma's wooden table. But I think sort of that ethos where of one of recycling, Because also, I remember having some, my mum gave me some sort of 1970s tubular metal chairs, which were kind of okay, quite interesting in some respects. And then I didn't particularly want any more chairs in my house. And then I think Pete Owen got them, I'm not sure, but they were passed around amongst other artists. So we did kind of, if there was something that we didn't particularly want that was given to us, we could pass it around. So that was really useful. So you did get a the sense that nothing really got wasted. And I've often wondered about those houses because, you know, although they were quite run down, they were particularly quite beautiful, like the big heavy front doors with the two panelled insets of like stained glass windows, leaded. And surrounding that, the kind of inner door frame had leaded windows with the number on the top in the skylight. And then all the doors inside were really nice heavy wood panelled doors. And then again, you had this proper windows, the sash windows, and the beautiful staircases, and also the tiles which went up the pathway and into the hallway. And I often wonder, you know, how much of that ever got reclaimed and how much of that kind of just got wasted and left behind and just destroyed in the rush of everything. So there's that sort of feeling of the whole kind of waste of it all, really, I suppose. But going back to the street, because the other people I remember in the street were two sisters, elderly sisters in Colville Road, who lived together. They were called Miss Griffiths, the two Miss Griffiths. And one of them, I think the older sister, she also was a regular gatepost, Lena. So like her face comes to mind most clearly. And I think she was actually in the houses opposite to me. The houses that were earmarked for demolition from number 31 onward, round that corner, round the sort of what would be from my window, the right hand side of that street that kind of went round the bend. And that's where Mrs. Swift would be as well. So I know those women knew each other quite a lot and they would be out there. And as I said before, Mrs. Swift suffered from agoraphobia. She'd been born in that house and raised all her children in the house. And sort of Mrs. Swift is like a memory, but also a kind of mystery as to what happened, really, to that her whole family, Sheila Thompson and so forth. Sheila has been spotted in Leighton, so she obviously stayed in the area. But the real tragedy, I think, was that those houses from 31 were knocked down, and Mrs. Swift's house was one of them. I think the Miss Griffiths house was on that side and knocked down as well. And similarly, where Tony Daly lived on the that bend, but on the opposite side of the road, those houses were knocked down as well. And it turned out in the end that none of those houses needed to have been knocked down, because now what you have is those horrible, like, noddy houses, which are kind of a really bad new build interpretation of the old house, which somehow, you know, are led you to believe that they fit in, but they don't. Those houses are in the place. So there's kind of stories like that whereby, you know, local residents lost their houses and it was totally unnecessary. And I think for Mrs. Swift, when someone suffers from agoraphobia and never goes out past their gatepost, I mean, what are the repercussions of that, you know? And nobody picked up her case, as far as I know. I'm sure the Residents Association did. And maybe the protesters knew about that, the anti-row protesters. But maybe Sheila Thompson didn't want her mum's plight publicised. And, you know, I wouldn't blame her. But there's a whole load of kind of speculation, really, around what may have occurred there. And and also other people. I know that my piece Household that I did in Scotland in 1990 was definitely inspired by my open studio, where I basically turned my house into a gallery and emptied it of all the personal contents and had installations. And that piece, Household, was sited, it was right on the street because I specifically wanted a ground floor level flat. And once I'd got the local residents involved through the two women who were vigilating the house, who lived on the street and also kept close watch on the house, because it did get attempted burglary, and they went out and sorted it out. And they said to me, Alison, we've had a few jobs in our time, but we've never been security, which I thought was quite funny because I never thought of them as that. But they were the sort of women that you wouldn't want to mess with. But that piece, because it was about the rent strikes, but then also a mirror image on the poll tax, which was happening there now, at that time then, the local poll tax union would use it as a meeting place as well. And in the house were just like tall life-size figures, photographs of figures, a man holding a baby, which had been blown up from newsprint, so they were all kind of very dotted. And I used the rubbish that I'd found in the house when I moved in as a kind of landscape across one of the rooms, the floors, this kind of quite desolate landscape with this man holding a child, it's a photographic image in the background. And another room was like strips of photographic paper that papered the room over an air vent, and it was an eviction scene with all the furniture had been thrown out of the house. So again, it related to this kind of threat of evictions that were going on during, you know, the M11 campaign or the lead up to it. And also local children in the area in Scotland were doing projects on the rent strikes. And so they were going in and using the house as well. When I showed up finally with Sean Dammer and his daughter, the historian I'd worked with, who lent me his oral history tapes from the period, we walked in the house, and it was, again, it did have the appearance, this interior, of a kind of squat, quite bare place. But the kitchen I'd made as a little tea room and a sort of cafe. So there were biscuits, a constant supply of tea and biscuits for visitors in there. Anyway, the three of us walked in, and this little boy came up and handed this little paper handout that I'd made for information on the project for people coming in, and went right up to Sean and said, this project is based on a series of interviews by Sean Dammer. And Sean was just so moved, his eyes completely glazed up, and he was chatting to the boy, and then he said to me, like, oh my god, this is fantastic, it does exactly what my work should have always done, which is to go back into the community. So he felt like really delighted about how it was going. And I did have another visit to the house because I was coming and going from London. I literally handed the flat over to the street, and I just wondered, actually, if the project had gone on, what would the possibilities have been. And another time I went in with David Hardin, the head of the environmental sculpture course at Glasgow School of Art, and a couple of his students, and it was crowded with people from the street, and they were sort of like amazed by that. So when I did finally leave, it was quite hard for me to go back to Colville Road. In fact, my mum has this saying that you should never go back, and constantly with my work and everything, I do go back, so I've got this morbid sense of curiosity. But my boyfriend, Howard Slater, did always go back, because he'd go to the Northcote pub with Pete and Matthew Howe and all the rest of them. And I didn't really want to do that. And although nothing much was said, I suppose it was almost like I actually felt quite emotionally attached, because I'd invested so much into my house, into the flat, and sort of, I suppose, clearing the gardens and just seeing how the knock-on effect really of what all the artists were doing, and then later how that just began to be undermined by lots of different circumstances, and the place was slowly going to rack and ruin. And I do remember that when I cleared out the next door back garden, and the lady next door started planting vegetables there, Tara cleared her garden downstairs and did a lawn. And the people in the house next door, that there were a group of young people from Lancashire, Pete, Martin, Paney, Sally, Tim, Judith and Howard, who then became my partner for a while. And they used to, it's quite strange, they used to sort of like, we'd hear all these sort of deep voices in the garden, and they would be like drinking beer and then throwing the empty cans into a pile. And so their garden was an absolute mess, and this huge pile of beer cans sort of built up. And then one day, it definitely was, because the two gardens, the others we'd cleared, and it must have had this subliminal influence, because they started clearing their garden. And Judith found, they dug in the middle of the garden, they found a pond that had been buried, and they sort of dug out the pond again and put fish in there, and then they grew all these flowers, and Judith like literally scattered all these seeds over the garden. It looked like a sort of, you know, wild flower field, like some garden designers sort of do nowadays. And I suppose also around that time we were kind of doing up our houses and everything. And the look was quite minimal in many ways. And also what people did with their gardens. And some people made sculpture gardens and so forth. And I suppose it was shabby chic, really, because then years later you've got all those kind of garden programs to teach people how to do things, to give them ideas, and like in many ways it was kind of all happening between Leighton and Wanstead in a slightly different way, and a slightly different aesthetics really, because I do think that with the kind of aesthetics of spatial decoration, if it's too perfect, like Habitat and Heels and so forth, it's a bit boring, and there has to be a little bit of shabby going on there. And I remember going to Maureen Paley's house and having a cup of tea, and she was telling me about her architect that was coming into her little place in Beck Road. And he was going to sharpen up her gallery a bit. And she said to me quite clearly that, you know, she doesn't want it too sharp, because then it would lose its character. And so she decided what she would do would keep those painted floorboards, those grey painted floorboards that have been clogged with paint and painted over for years, and then, you know, whatever happened around that would be to sharpen it up. But she didn't want to lose the quality of that kind of Victorian terrace, which I think is interesting. So I suppose, I just thought of something else. Was the time when I mentioned I got burgled, and I went to the telephone box on the corner because I never had a telephone there, and called the police and reported it to the police, and this constable came round, and I came down from the top of the house and opened the door, and he sort of just immediately walked in and took a right into Tara's front living room, except she wasn't living there anymore. There were these guys, and I just sort of followed him in there, and then I was so shocked with what I saw, and the constable just said, "This is a right dump." And all the curtains had been pulled, and there was like the whole space just felt grey. There were like armchairs and stuff in there. There were like fag butts everywhere and beer cans, and then this sort of drum kit in the corner. And one of the guys used to play this drum kit. And you can imagine, like, if I was in the house upstairs, I would just have to leave the house, go to the Northcote or somewhere to get out of the house while he played the drums, which was completely antisocial. And sometimes I just wondered how some of the long-term residents would put up with some of the noise that was actually kind of happening around that time, with people who actually never really done up the houses, the Acme people, but came in on the back of Acme people or whatever, and just would use the place as they thought fit, which wasn't exactly what they were intended for. And in this living room, the policeman said that it stank of marijuana, and I just thought, you know, God, you know, it really kind of sums it up, like this just complete, you know, sort of, I don't know, it seemed like a kind of disrespect for people living around in quite close proximity. And I did at that point just think, God, I wonder if the guys themselves had stolen the audio equipment as an insurance scam, but you just don't know, really. And I just thought, it's none of my business, so I'm just going to keep out of it. But I did think at that point, well, you know, they're not locking their windows downstairs, they're not really bothering to lock the doors up properly, and they're not putting the front door on the mortise, so like, what's the point of me sort of keeping my stuff here? And at that time I was living there, and it's just not going to be safe, you know, the door could just be kicked down and that's it. So that's when I moved and decided to use the place as a studio. And as I say, the damp had come into the front room as well. So it was quite sad, really, how a place could deteriorate so quickly just because certain people were moving out. And so around about 92 anyway, quite a few artists were moving out. But I didn't obviously hand my keys in because I'd decided to use it by then as a studio, and it wasn't practical to be moving around doing projects up and down the country, because basically I felt that one had to go where the work was, really, because I was living basically from project to project and teaching block to teaching block, and then having bits of part-time teaching in between, and visiting different art schools up and down the country. So it was like getting to the point where you couldn't really be away for a long period of time. You had to sort of, it was becoming like a squat, really, I thought, you know, where you just sort of had to almost be there to guard the fort, or at least be able to come back every night from, you know, a job nearby, or just be there all the time, like a studio, and one couldn't really afford to do that. You know, you needed to have work. So I suppose that's how it sort of, it changed. And I suppose there was a part of me that felt that in a way I'd been pushed out, that the environmental circumstances were actually becoming impossible, really, for me to kind of negotiate. And then, as I say, that's when kind of a lot more squatters started to move in. I think sort of, coming up to the point where, because I think I probably actually moved out around 1993 to 94, probably around the spring, because that's when I started looking for a place of my own, because I actually walked past an estate agent in Leighton, and I noticed that the properties had really dropped, and that I could afford to get in on the backside end of the housing market. And I knew that a lot of other Acme artists were being offered places. Like, sometimes it would be that their house wasn't going to be demolished after all, and so they were buying them really cheaply. So I decided that, you know, that would be a kind of good move. And also, my boyfriend Howard Slater was in a much more regular job, working ironically in a housing association office. So that enabled, we could actually get a mortgage. And I remember actually looking at houses, and I turned it into a whole project. And I must have actually looked at about 100 houses. And I remember sort of telling this to my mum. I mean, because I'd love interiors anyway. And it was just so interesting, looking at all these different kinds of houses that you could get. And also so sad as well, because a lot of houses around that time had been repossessed, because of all the negative equity. And I did tend to look in all around Waltham Forest, and then I looked around some houses in Hackney, and then I went down to Stratford, and I collected all the little pictures and descriptions and everything. And yeah, some of the houses were in quite a state of repair, and some of them were like fairly decent. But it was actually quite easy to kind of eventually whittle it down to the last three places, which seemed like the sort of place I would like to live. But there was basically there was that much on offer, you know, and some of them were really cheap. And I did look at some houses around the Leytonstone area, but quite frankly, I just didn't want to live there again. And also because of like what the motorway being there, and there were some houses that were right on the edge of the motorway going for something like 17,000, and that was before the motorway was built, so you didn't know. So people, that was the amount of money people were losing. And it's like, does one want to make a profit out of someone else's suffering, really? So the whole thing about the area had quite an impact, really. And around that time, I think it must have been April 1994, I received a phone call from a friend of mine's mum. Now, when I used to do the mail out at Whitechapel Art Gallery, it was run by a woman called Emma Aylin, who then became a friend of mine through my doing the mail out. And her mother, Sylvia Aylin, is the UK specialist on the Sylvia Pankhurst story. And Sylvia Aylin rung me up and said, "Look, Alison, you've got to come down to Claremont Road and see the art house. It's, you know, absolutely fantastic." She was really raving about it. And she didn't really quite know how I felt, because I just felt like I really didn't want to go back. I didn't want to walk down Coalfield Road and see my house and see what kind of state it had got in or whatever, or was it boarded up? Because I didn't know what the situation was, because I'd actually handed my keys into, I just went down to the Acme offices and handed them into Roger. So I didn't have to wait at the house for it to be boarded up and all the rest of it, because there were still people living downstairs. So it was quite easy and simple for me. I just handed the keys in and that was that. And So I then also got another call from Maggie Lambert, who had been taking photographs around the area of the anti-road protesters, and would I go down? It was really exciting and all the rest of it. But I just felt like, my God, it's becoming like this big circus. And like, you know, the local people had been campaigning for years. And why didn't these protesters and people come in earlier? Why did they come right at the very end of the campaign? Because they weren't there very long. I think it was 93, 94. And certainly in Claremont Road, the anti-road protesters were there around 8 months, because it was April 1994 when the art house was open. And then it was November 94 where the final campaign actually ended. So, and I know that some artists didn't want to walk down Claremont Road because there was all the furniture outside and everything, and they felt like they were intruding on someone else's space. And sometimes the protesters would ask for money. So, but some artists did join the campaigners, and that, you know, and a lot of artists had been part of the No M11 campaign anyway, and we'd put the No M11 posters in our windows and so forth. But and the art house is very much a sort of metaphor of that, I think. Coming together of artists and protesters. And I'm not sure if I did walk down Colville Road, but I think, you know, because even my neighbours, the northern people next door, had by that time moved to Leytonstone, so they didn't live there anymore. And anyway, I do remember going down Claremont Road and being really surprised by how it changed. And the houses had been all painted up. And that was actually quite shocking, really, because I just thought, how can anyone do that to those beautiful houses? Particularly the kind of daisy chain of flowers, which kind of made it look like some sort of hippie 1960s kind of imagery, dripping paint, you know, not even sort of painted neatly with respect to the building, because the attitude was, oh, well, the building's going to be knocked down anyway. I don't know what the attitude was, but that's what it seemed like. Sort of. Anyway, I got to the house, and actually, before I got to the house, there was this other house that was sort of gutted, actually, and I had a look inside, and it was a bit like a shed. It looked like an old fisherman's shed, and there were bicycles hanging up, and I sort of, and some protesters and anti-road protesters there. I particularly remember a man with a very long pointed beard, grey pointed beard, and I also saw Mick Roberts, who was a local resident turned protester. And I say that because he used to dress, and I think you can really see it in Neil Goodwin's film, rather like an old man at the start. I think he even had a flat cap, you know. And then as the protests went on, he became more and more alive. And his clothes changed, like he was wearing a beanie hat and he was wearing jeans, and he actually began to look younger. So I think like the protest was actually very good for some people. It just actually brought out this kind of youthful thing in them. And I think Mick Roberts was quite symptomatic of one of those people. And he'd got a scaffold that he put on his roof. I don't remember seeing that, but I just know that from the archives. So I want to try and keep the two things separate as to what one remembers. And then anyway, I went, the art house was like very brightly painted outside. To me, that really didn't really do anything, because I thought that you could actually probably do that a lot better. And there were some ends of terraces which were painted, which quite carefully with text. That for me, that worked much better. And it also reminded me, the ones that were painted quite carefully, of in 1987... when I was on the underground, the central line, going east. So I went on a train past Claremont Road, and there were some backs of terraces with gardens going onto the railway line, and one house had in big white letters, "Why bother?" And it was huge, and it was like a billboard for the railway line, the commuters to see. And then as a few months passed by, the next door neighbour, immediately next door, put up in big similar white text, "Why not?" So you had these two questions side by side, and local people going past all knew exactly what that was about. And that was about the feelings of people who lived on the motorway. Like, well, why bother? Because the whole place is going to get run down anyway. And another more positive voice saying, why not bother? And keep going and keep the place in a good state and keep protesting, I suppose, most importantly. And that was before the Claremont Road painted buildings. And the art house, I can't remember if it had a corridor as you went in. I have a feeling that it was a big open space and had been partly knocked down. And I mostly remember the upstairs rooms with the yellow, sort of rusty pinky paint on one room with the circle of tea lights and the text on the cupboards and the shoes and various objects with grass growing out of them and a sort of sketchy classical image and text, and then the bathroom with the rose that went down the plug hole. And I thought that it was all very kind of obvious in a way, the imagery. But I thought what was very interesting about it was the fact that, I mean, I did find out later that it was all done in a hurry, with sort of the bailiff sort of around the corner. But what was really interesting was that the house was like a catalyst, and there was a connection between what I'd done with household, although people didn't know about that because I didn't know any of the Acme artists who were involved in Art House. And I think it was quite symptomatic of the time, really, and the sort of protest culture, I suppose. But it was a catalyst which drew people to the house to publicise the protest, and that there were workshops again going on in there and meetings to do with the road protests. So it was like this idea of the house becomes an open house for the street, and I really liked that idea actually. And the fact that, you know, aesthetically, because it sort of had this hippie kind of feeling to it, I don't know, that neo, I can't even remember the word, neo-naturist sort of attitude to it. Once one actually saw through that, which was just simply a question of a kind of taste or style, and got to the root core meaning of what was kind of going on, then that was where the interest actually lied, I thought. But at the same time, I felt very strange about the whole thing, because I thought this was a place where I'd lived for, well, in the next street for quite a few years, and it has become a sort of alien place, and one felt like a kind of tourist within another culture, which had been placed on that street with another group of residents. So it was quite a strange feeling, and it was strange to see the street looking as it did. I mean, there weren't any sculptures and stuff outside the street apart from cars that had been reconfigured. There was furniture out in the street, and the netting hadn't gone up, and there weren't planks across the houses or tree houses and things like that. That sort of all came just after the art house in order, I remember, because my boyfriend Howard, when he went to the Northcote, he would come back and say he'd always look through that down that street and say, my God, you know, they've got the netting up now. And then I do remember seeing it on the news. But I never wanted to go back after that, because for me, something had really gone. And it was quite heart-wrenching, really. So I guess I was quite emotionally attached. So that was sort of most of my memories, really. But I mean, it was an incredible time, because I think, you know, there was so much sort of network going on, but we didn't really see it in that kind of business orientated way. That it was, I do think there were probably also more opportunities for artists then, because I think all the opportunities that were open at the Whitechapel, which has distinctly changed and become much more conventional in many ways, because they did have some like really good workshop programs where artists would go and do residencies. And I remember Sharon Kivland doing a really nice piece with these school children, where she got each child to simply say their name again and again on an audio tape, and she took their portrait, and she made this really interesting audio tape where all their names were overlaid and all their faces lined the gallery walls. And also for me, it was I met a lot of people at the Whitechapel, because it was more like an open house, I think, for artists. And and when Jenny moved to Camden Art Centre and became the director, she wrote to me and asked me if I would like to do a show there. And I had the huge room in the Whitechapel, and that was in 92, and I had 8 large derelict interiors in there, and that was when I met Maureen Paley, because she just came up and said how much she liked the work. And also John Roberts was involved in that, because he gave a talk about my work and its social metaphors and so forth. And I had also been in a show with him called Renegotiations, Class, Modernity and Photography. Because he even wrote to me when I was in Japan. I spent 7 months in Japan in 92, because my job at Brighton had ended, so I decided to do that. And at that time, I was, as I say, using my Coalfield Road as a studio, and it was at that point, after the burglary, that I decided to go to Japan and decided to move most of my things out before I left, so that what was left behind, it didn't matter too much if anything happened to it. And when I came back from that trip in Japan, I found that there was a woman squatting my studio, which was a really weird feeling, you know, to come back and to find someone had put their mattress on the floor in my old bedroom and had all their belongings around about and was using my washing machine, and while I was still paying the rent and all the bills. So that was really odd, and so that kind of, I rang up Acme and told them, but Sarah Greengrass's attitude, well, is if Alison, you go away to Japan for 7 months, that's going to happen, because it was becoming more and more, there were more squatters around, and I suppose she was right. And I just sort of moved the stuff back down to Tara's house, because this was one of Tara's friends downstairs. And because no one was there and all the doors were, you know, as open as usual. And I just left a note saying that I didn't give permission for her to use my space, and therefore I've moved her belongings back down. And then sort of when I came back to the studio, there was a note under my door like how shocked she was and blah, blah, blah. And this woman turned out to be like really quite upper class. And I just thought, you know, why are you choosing to actually live like this, you know, in this really transitory way? And I think there were people who were like just living like that out of curiosity, where they had mummy and daddy in the background and could quite afford to go off and buy a nice flat. But just like the excitement of, you know, squatting, where there were a lot of us who had no choice about our living situation. So I just kind of like thought that that was kind of really dysfunctional, actually. And I think it was, it wasn't, I just carried on using the studio and things like that. When things like that happened, I just kind of ignored them, and I thought, well, I'll just give up the studio when I want to give it up, and did. But I think, you know, like with all that sort of networking that was going on, it was really good because I remember when we did the Open Studios in 88, there was a curator, Helen Sloane, who lived in Walthamstow and worked at the William Morris Gallery. And she was trying to get some installational work to be shown. There was quite a big exhibitions room in the William Morris Gallery for installation work. And she came to the Open Studios and asked me to submit a proposal, which I did. It wasn't accepted. I do remember we had to go for an interview. And Geoffrey Dennis was one of the people on the panel. So they had an artist as well as people who worked at the gallery. And I didn't get that. But then in 1992, when she worked at Oldham Gallery, I was commissioned to interview spinners and worked in the archives with these old audio tapes, went out and made new audio tapes and expanded the archive as well as building a gallery installation. And that's what seemed to happen. You'd find that one project would be spin off from the next because there were always people from other galleries coming to see work. And I'm wondering actually if that sort of whole thing about studio visits, that seemed to happen much more, and there was more of an emphasis on studio practice. And whereas now everything is more focused on the internet, and you have to submit computer-based images, which I hate because I'm still a low-tech person. And I still like the quality of the grainy photograph, and I think the quality of slides are better than digital images and PowerPoints, which people seem to kind of use much more now. But when I look up back on that whole period of time, and if I think, well, do I think that could ever happen again? It would have to be no. And I would say no because it could never happen on such a large scale because, you know, the whole site number of artists' houses that were there, which were quite a few, probably, I don't know, about 100 or so. That there just wouldn't be that kind of availability, and at that time, you know, there was a lot of redevelopment. It was the start of all the redevelopment programs going on, and massive clearances down in places like Docklands, and there was a lot of short life property, housing associations. Which actually in 1994, one of the reasons why I decided to buy, because partly because of the slump, and I knew one of my friends was watching the stock market, and he just said to me, there's going to be another slump. I mean, my friend who watches the stock market is sort of a socialist bloke, and he just said, Alison, if you don't get anywhere now, you're never going to get anywhere because there's going to be this massive slump coming, and the house prices are going to go up. So I took his advice, but also at the other side, like at the back of me, so to speak, the housing association that I was in was folding up, and so were many, many other housing associations. So it was going to become more difficult to get a housing association. And then the whole law had changed about squatters' rights, and I would never have wanted to go back to squatting because it was something I'd done, which had its pros and clearly had its cons, really. And so it was almost like this was the option that was open to me, and I was quite lucky then because now that option isn't open to people, and certainly not people like myself, and or people, you know, because the prices are just so ridiculously high. So I knew that that was what I had to do, and I'd been warned by my friend, luckily. So I think also there are sort of like smaller pockets of that kind of thing happening, like, you know, with the 491 gallery in Leytonstone, but nowhere near on that kind of scale, you know, with like a warehouse and a little row of houses which have a peppercorn rent and which have been painted up, you know, with a bar, a gallery and studios and a cinema and back garden. But that kind of exists as a kind of smaller version, I suppose. But I don't think you'd ever get anything on that sort of scale. And I think also it was quite particular because it was before technology. Like, you know, I didn't even have a telephone, and I was like just corresponding to galleries by letter, and galleries wrote to me to invite me to show or give me a studio. Whereas if more technology had been available at that stage, I think the networking would have been kind of heightened, and certainly not more face to face like it was, where the Northcote was a meeting point and a place where people were actively engaging in discussion. And I think that kind of really sort of got people working, because you was in an area where there were lots of people working away, and there were information as to what was going on, and people would help each other get shows and so forth. Again, that was quite particular to that place, I think. And in terms of the Roe protest, I suppose it's quite difficult because there's a very visible side of the Roe protest, which is the anti-road protesters who actively sought publicity and got publicity. And then there's the other side of the local people, which goes back to about 1963, which is, there are some cut-ins, but it's not so publicised, it's not so dramatic. And sort of a more ordinary protest, I suppose. Although they did use make T-shirts and newspapers and things like that. That history seems to, I suppose, until now, until part of this research gets out, has been quite submerged. So I think it would be good to actually draw that history up, because that's the hidden history really at the moment. And I do think the protest, although the road was going to happen, and there were parts in the campaign where people started to believe that perhaps they will be able to stop the road, and I think that became because of, I think also Wolf and Forest had been supporting the campaign for many years, and then towards the end of the campaign they began to object. So that was quite a big move. But I think a lot of people, especially the artists, knew that the road was going to happen, and there was sort of no stopping it really. So I think we were probably quite cynical really. But I do think the campaign had an effect. It did have an effect on the policies for road building. And it did It was became the biggest road protest in Europe, and I think it's really interesting the way the strategies which we used, which were quite aligned with contemporary art and Fluxus and Situationism, and I think there was a certain amount of crossover going on between the artists and the protesters in that sense, and that was really interesting as well from that point of view. And it was really good that these people were prepared to spend the last couple of years pursuing that campaign. But I think there's a real sadness about it for the people who lived in that area, like myself, because I think everyone was quite affected by it. People say they were emotionally detached, but I'm not sure that they were, because there was a certain amount of investment going into the area, and as I say, it was a very exciting and very productive period in a lot of artists' working lives, and it was a really nice community to actually be living in before it started to demise, really.